heart problems relative to e-cigarettes.
Is screening for lung cancer really a good idea?
Transcatheter aortic valve replacement.
And a risk factor for premature death that's being ignored.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on February 3rd, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, that was a rather sobering introduction with a risk for premature death that's being ignored. That's in The Lancet, taking a look at socioeconomic status.
In my opinion, this is a fascinating study. When I talk about risk factors for premature death, for non-communicable risk factors, this is a risk factor that I really hadn't considered seriously. So there's an effort from the WHO called 25 by 25. It's to reduce death by non-communicable risk factors by 25% by the year 2025. Those risk factors are things that you and I have routinely talked about. Cigarette smoking, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, high alcohol intake, and physical inactivity. Well, socioeconomic status also ends up being a risk factor for death. The question is it independent of these, and how significant is it compared to these? These investigators did a meta-analysis of 1.7 million men and women from different cohorts collected around the world that have been followed up for 13 years. They went look at all the risk factors we mentioned. Aside from diabetes and cigarette smoking, lower socioeconomic status was more important or as important than the other risk factors that I've mentioned. And this is not something that we're routinely addressing. Let me put it in terms that I think we can understand. For people between the ages of 40 and 85, being a smoker reduces your lifespan by about 4.8 years. Diabetes reduces it 3.9 years. Being in a lower socioeconomic status reduces it by 2.1 years. That's more than you would get with inactivity, high alcohol intake, and obesity. So unless we address socioeconomic status, we're not going to reach the goal of reducing mortality 25% by the year 2025.
And so I think this is a really laudable goal, and I think it's also important that we've identified this as a risk factor. However, I would also say that low SES is something that is so multifactorial, it's a whole lot more complicated than we really need you to quit smoking.
And I agree. What things do we need to do? We need to invest in our children. We need to get the welfare mix right. We need to provide safety nets, implement active labor market policy, strengthen local communities. So these are things that aren't being addressed by looking at the other risk factors.
Yeah, and is absolutely a problem that everybody is going to have to put their shoulder to the plow to try to overcome.
And by the way, this study wasn't done in low-income countries. This was done in medium and high-income countries.
More on that. Let's turn from here then to JAMA Cardiology. Gosh, the debate about e-cigarettes goes on and on. In fact, just yesterday I saw yet one more study that said, oops, they're safer than traditional cigarettes. I don't know if that's a lot like saying that the giant fire-breathing lizard is safer than the giant fire-breathing dragon. But in any case, now here is something that I thought was really interesting, the impact of e-cigarette use on the heart.
And as you mentioned, because there's no routine smoke involved, they're thought to be safer than routine cigarettes. Now, I agree with you, the comparison's not so good. But the real question is, do they increase your risk of premature death, and in particular, cardiovascular death? We don't have long enough data to look at that endpoint yet. So there are surrogate markers. We know that cigarette smoking is associated with adverse cardiovascular events through specific mechanisms. Would those same mechanisms possibly be activated by e-cigarettes? These investigators looked at 42 individuals, 23 that were e-cigarette users and 19 controls. And they measured some of these mechanisms. And the two that I'm going to mention is what's called sympathetic activity, and the other is called oxidative stress. When a person smokes a routine cigarette, there's an increase in the sympathetic activity. By the way, that increases your heart rate, that increases your blood pressure, it increases the stress on your heart and contributes to atherosclerosis, and it increases the oxidative stress as well. And that increases the input of cholesterol into the arteries and increases the risk of heart disease. Well, in these 23 e-cigarette users, they noticed the exact same things. And by the way, it's not while they were smoking e-cigarettes, this was afterwards. So it looks like even though they had smoked previously, and it had ended, the same risk factors are present.
I will remind everyone that sympathetic activity is that fight or flight response where our bodies sort of prepare us to, ooh, the saber-toothed tigers just come onto the scene and I need to run or fight. What I want to know is there any quantification of the impact of e-cigarettes in comparison to traditional cigarettes? with regard to the activation of these mechanisms?
Great question. No, they did not do that. They didn't compare e-cigarettes to cigarettes. The next question is, well, this is a surrogate market. Does it really translate into increased risk of cardiovascular disease? We haven't extended the study long enough here to know whether that's true for e-cigarettes as well.
Well, we know that my view on this is that these things ought to just go out the window along with the traditional cigarettes. I'm sure there's something really great about the tobacco plant. I just don't know what it is.
What do you want to talk about next, Elizabeth?
Well, we can stay in JAMA Cardiology. This very popular procedure, transcatheter aortic valve replacement. Okay, now what?
I enjoyed this particular study because I think it's changed the paradigm of how we treat individuals that have a blockage of their aortic valve. And specifically, those individuals that are considered to be at extremely high risk for having surgery. In the past, we didn't have any other options. Now we can put a valve in percutaneously, that is through the artery, and the short-term results in clinical trials suggest that it's beneficial. It can improve the quality of life. Now that's in clinical trials. The question is, if you look out in the routine community, do you get the same results? So these investigators looked at the short and long-term health status of surviving patients that had had transaortic valve replacement in unselected population, almost 32,000 patients. And what they discovered is that the 30-day outcome and the one-year outcome was great. Two-thirds of the individuals were alive and improved. What about the other third? A half of them didn't survive the year, and the other half of that third didn't get any better. This tells me that we need to do a better job at patient selection. Maybe the reason they had symptoms was because they had kidney disease or lung disease or some other comorbid condition.
But if you need to have an aortic valve replacement, you're saying that the percutaneous approach is really quite good.
It is, and specifically targeting those individuals that have a high risk of having a complication with surgery. Those that have a low risk with surgery, I think many of us would say that's probably still the procedure of choice at this point.
Well, now that's an interesting observation. Why do you say that?
If you have a low risk of having a complication, and particularly if you're younger, the valves that we put in, the metal valves or the tissue valves we put in surgery, are likely to last longer than the stented valves that we use with a percutaneous procedure.
Finally then, let's turn to something else that's a real world study and one that in some respects I think reaches a kind of cautionary conclusion. In JAMA Internal Medicine, what's it look like when we really roll out robust lung cancer screening?
And this has been controversial since it was recommended in 2013. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force gave a grade B recommendation for screening for lung cancer. That is based primarily on a single trial. So let's fast forward to now. Let's test that in a community setting. So these investigators looked at 8 academic VA hospitals in which over 93,000 patients were cared for. How many of them are considered to be high risk and should be recommended? What are the procedures that we do? How many will have it? And how often is it successful in determining whether there's cancer that could be curable? And how often does it reveal nodules that probably aren't a problem? First of all, it took a tremendous effort to do this and do it right. It was very expensive. In the end, what they discovered is for every 1,000 patients screened, only 10 would be diagnosed with early stage lung cancer that could be curable. There would be 5 that would have advanced stage lung cancer that was not curable, 20 patients that would go unnecessary invasive procedures. And then there would be another 550 that would have incidental findings and or have to have additional CT scans in follow-up. You have to ask yourself, in the balance, is it really beneficial?
And the answer is likely no, at least in my estimation. However, what is it that we're actually going to offer to people who have been lifetime heavy smokers who are at increased risk for having lung cancer?
A couple things. The low-dose CT scan isn't everything it's cracked up to be. I mean, even among these 8 centers, there was a tremendous variability in the identification of the nodules and reading the x-rays. I don't think low-dose CT scans, as this study and others have suggested, are really the ideal screening. I hope that in the future, blood tests will provide the biomarkers that allow us to determine lung cancer, but even in its earlier stages. And it has to have a low false positive rate. Low-dose CT scans, for example, have a high false positive rate.
I agree. I think that we are moving into the arena where we're going to be able to detect these things by simply taking a blood test. And that's got a lot more promise. Perhaps at the beginning, it's going to be in conjunction with something like CT, but then ultimately move into something that's more practical on its own.
And there are 2 issues. One is having the test and then applying it to the right population. Because if you have a low-risk population, then all the tests do is amplify the false positives. For example, there's a follow-up study to this that showed, since the recommendation, who is now having scanning? Well, there are more people that have no risk or low risk having the scanning done than people at high risk. Despite the recommendations, we're even applying it to the wrong patient population, which further complicates the issue.
And makes things way more expensive.
And less useful.
Exactly. On that note, I'll talk about that one then in the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.